Te Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 24, Chanting the Song by Lord Shiva. What verse is on the board?
Two.
Two. So two doesn't have a purport, but since that's the one on the board, we'll chant it together, and then we'll go on to the next verse, which does have a purport. Haryakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Vrikasamgyaya Turyam Dravinase Vibhu Haryakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Rikasam Gaya Turyam Dravina Se Vibhu Haryakshaya Dini Prachim Haryakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Vrikasam Gaya Turyam Dravina Se Vibhu Haryakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Vrikasam Gaya Turyam Dravina Se Vibhu Dakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Kishandrikasam Gaya Turyam Dravina Se Vibhu Haryakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Chandrakasam Gaya Duryam Dravina Se Vibhu Haryakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Sikasamgaya Amarina Sevibhu Dakshaya Dishat Prachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Sikasamgaya Vaishnavis. Vayakshaya Vachim Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Vrikasamgaya Turyam Dravina Se Vibhu Dumrakeshaya Dakshina Pratichim Vrikasamgaya Turyam Dravina Haryakshaya, unto Haryaksha, Adishat, delivered, Prachim, eastern, Dumrakeshaya, unto Dumrakesha, Dakshina, the southern side, Pratichim, the western side, Vrikasamgaya, unto his brother, whose name was Vrika, Turya, the northern side, Dravinase, unto another brother of his named Dravina, Vibhu, the master. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Please repeat. Maharaj Vijitashva offered the eastern part of the world to his brother Haryaksha, the southern part to Dumrakesh, the western part to Vrika, and the northern part to Dravina. So text 3. Antardana gatim shakral labvantara dana samgitaha apatya triam adata shikandinyam susamatam. Please repeat. Antardana of disappearance. Gatim, achievement. Shakrat, from King Indra. Labva, getting. Antardana, of the name. Samgitaha, so nominated. Apatya, children. Trayam, three. Adata, begot. Shikandinya, and Shikandini, his wife. Susamata, approved by everyone. Translation, please repeat. Formerly, Maharaj Vijitasva, please the King of Heaven, Indra, and from him received the title Antardana. His wife's name was Shikandini, and by her he begot three good sons. Purport. Maharaj Vijitashva was known as Antardana, which means disappearance. He received this title from Indra, and it refers to the time when Indra stole Maharaj Prithu's horse from the sacrificial arena. Indra was not visible to others when he was stealing the horse, but Maharaj Prithu's son, Vijitashva, could see him. Yet despite his knowing that Indra was taking away his father's horse, Vijitashva did not disturb him. This indicates that Maharaj Vijitashva respected the right persons. Although Indra was stealing the horse from his father, Vijitashva knew perfectly well that Indra was not an ordinary thief. Since Indra was a great and powerful demigod and servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vijitashva purposefully excused him due to sentiment only, even though Indra was acting wrongly. Thus, Indra became very pleased with Vijitashva at that time. The demigods have the great mystic power of being able to appear and disappear according to their will. And since Indra was pleased with Vijitashva, he bestowed this mystic power upon him. Thus, Vijitashva became known as Antardana. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshura Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasati Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So there's a mystic power by which one can appear and disappear at will. Sometimes it appears that devotees have this power. Maybe the temple managers. The temple managers know. The devotees can appear and disappear at will. So... We see that these powers are widespread. But they actually are real powers. And people would like to have them. You know, for example, the military, you know, they have these airplanes called stealth airplanes because they're not visible to radar. You know, just like their different senses that we have. You know, this mystic power is about being invisible to visual sight. You know, but you know, the militaries these days, they have radar, you know, which they can use to detect, you know, different kinds of airplanes and things like that coming from a distance so that they can see, you know, over the horizon what's going on. But the United States military has developed these airplanes that are invisible to radar. You know, they call them stealth airplanes. So it's, yeah, you know, these are powers that, you know, people would like to have. But the real way to get them is by, you know, pleasing, you know, the ultimately Krishna or his demigod assistants, like this Vijitasva. You know, he got this mystic power of being able to appear and disappear at will by pleasing Indra, who had this power by the grace of Krishna. In Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto, there's the Uddhava Gita, where Krishna is giving many instructions to Uddhava, his dear friend and devotee. And in the course of these instructions, Krishna gives a whole list of mystic powers. You know, the ability to become greater than the greatest, smaller than the smallest. There are many of them. There are many major mystic powers and minor mystic powers, and Krishna goes all through them. And he explains that the way to get them is to meditate on different aspects of Krishna and Krishna's universal form. And in that way, one is able to get these mystic powers. So, I mean, one of the mystic powers is called Durdarshan, the ability to see things at a distance. So in India, if you've been in India, you know that Indian television is called in Hindi Durdarshan. It means the ability to see something, you know, at a distance. So that's actually a mystic power. And there's also a similar mystic power that Krishna describes called Durshravana, the ability to hear at a distance. So the Bhagavad Gita, as we have it, comes through the exercise of these mystic powers. If we study the Bhagavad Gita very carefully, we see that, you know, it's a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. But it's being related to the blind king, Duryodhana, who's sitting in his tent. Dhritarashtra. It's being related to the blind king, Dhritarashtra, who's sitting in his tent at some distance from the battlefield, and the conversation's being related to him by his secretary, Sanjaya, who has, by the grace of his spiritual master, Vyasadeva, these powers to be able to see and hear the conversation and see and hear what was going on the battlefield some distance away. So the Bhagavad Gita comes to us partially through the exercise of these mystic powers by Sanjaya, by the grace of his spiritual master, Vyasadeva. So, I mean, we may wonder, well, why aren't great devotees manifesting these powers today? Be very nice if I could go to a scientific conference and float 5 feet off the ground, give a speech about these things. But apparently these things are considered distractions from pure devotional service. We learn that pure devotees, they're really not so interested in manifesting, you know, these mystic powers. Srila Prabhupada was once, you know, asked, you know, about his mystic powers. He said, yes, my mystic power is that I can convert, you know, mlechas, you know, into devotees of Lord Krishna. So that's the kind of, you know, mystic power that we are being given an opportunity to get, you know, the ability to assist Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas in transforming non-devotees into devotees. And so that's our mystic power, you know, that we can learn how to get. So obviously here we're talking about kings. There's Maharaj Vijitashva, you know, great king, who was ruling over this earth planet long ago. And actually until just recently, you know, most of the earth was ruled, you know, by kings. To some extent, the earth still is being ruled by, you know, various kinds of royal families. England, you know, they have a queen, and maybe there'll be a king, you know, at some point. And they have this whole British Commonwealth, which is technically, you know, under the royal family, the queen. You go to Canada, Australia, you'll see the queen, you know, on their money and things like that. You know, Saudi Arabia has a king. Japan is still technically ruled by an emperor. So many countries in Europe, Spain, Norway, Sweden, so many of them have kings, queens. So there's still some remnant of these royal traditions. Of course, they're very much degraded, and that's why they don't have, you know, the same power, you know, that they did in the time of the great Rajarshis. You know, as time went on, you know, they became very degraded, and, you know, people revolted against them, so that now most of the power in the world is in the hands not of the Kshatriyas, but in the hands of the Vaishyas, you know, the, you know, mercantile class, and the Sudras, the laborers. And so we, you know, we see that, you know, in America, we've got, you know, the primary example of that, of, you know, country being ruled basically by Vaishyas, by, you know, industrialists. So we see that the main activity of people is buying and selling. Every activity, everything that exists has a price on it. Whether it's an education or entertainment or food or transportation, you know, everything is bought and sold. And that's what most people are doing. They're either accumulating money or spending money. You just have to think how many times in the average day a person is buying or selling something. It's going on all the time because that's how society's been arranged. So these royal orders from the Sun Dynasty and the Moon Dynasty, the Suryavamsa and the Moon Dynasty, were ruling the earth in very ancient times. And now, even though there may be some kings and queens still left, they don't have very much power. You know, there's a queen in England. She has some power, but most of the power is in the hands of the parliament, like that. I mean, still sometimes, because these people are very attracted, you know, to the idea of kings and queens and princes and princesses. So sometimes they become like rock stars or celebrities, and they can, you know, have some influence in that way. But they, because they're not really of such good character, and they don't really know the actual purpose of human life, you know, they're not very effective. So this is, Srila Prabhupada said that Kali Yuga, it's, you know, the age of democracy, where, you know, you just have, you know, people electing leaders. And because the people aren't very educated, they elect improper leaders, and therefore they have to suffer under the governments that they themselves have elected. So, I mean, Srila Prabhupada has said that this could be, this situation could be turned around if the Krishna consciousness movement educates people about what a real leader, you know, should be, what the real standard of leadership is. And then people, they might eventually come to elect, you know, proper, you know, proper leaders, Krishna conscious leaders. That would be the ideal situation in this, in this age of Kali. Another topic that's mentioned in this verse in purport is, you know, the fact that, you know, this Maharaj Vijitashva had good sons, good children by his wife, Shikandini. That's a very, you know, great responsibility. You know, it's said, you know, that we have a debt to the forefathers, and the way that one in Vedic culture satisfies this debt, repays this debt, is by having children in turn. So that's a very nice service to Krishna, you know, to bring, you know, nice Krishna conscious children into the world. Of course, not everybody can engage in that service. It's like myself, you know, I'm kind of the end of the line. You have to think, you know, in terms of Vedic, you know, the Vedic understanding, if you trace your ancestors back, you know, you go to your grandparents and your great-grandparents and your great-grandparents, eventually you'll come to some Prajapatis, some demigods, you know, who exist, you know, at some higher level of the cosmos. And you trace it back even further, you come to Swayambhuva Manu, Shatarupa, who come from Brahma. And that's why Lord Brahma, he's called Pitamaha, the original grandfather. So if we trace our ancestry back like that, you go back millions and millions of years. So all of us, you know, we're the product of millions and millions and millions of years of reproductive activity by different personalities on this planet, and going eventually back to the heavenly planets, all the way back to Lord Brahma at the very beginning of the Kalpa. Of course, the materialistic scientists would say, yeah, if you trace your ancestry back, eventually you come to some ape men, and then to some monkeys, and then to some rats, and then to some fish, and then to some chemicals. You know, so the original grandfather would be chemicals, according to that point of view. So sometimes, you know, there are some who continue that process of generation of good population, And that, and then some who don't do it biologically. But if we don't biologically do it, then you know, we should try through teaching to have good offspring, in the sense that, you know, teachers, spiritual masters, they, you can say they also have offspring in the form of their students or, you know, disciples. So, does anybody have any questions or comments? Archita.
This business of the whole world being ruled by one monarch at one point in the past. Prabhupada has mentioned that numerous times, so many passages. But even within our society, there are those who question this concept. They say that there's no empiric evidence for that, and they just don't buy the fact that at one point in the past, there was one ruler of the entire planet. Maybe you can comment on that.
Well, there are a few things to say about it. I mean, Srila Prabhupada said it's not that it was one ruler, you know, directly ruling everywhere. As mentioned here, there were subordinate kings ruling in various parts of the world. So it wasn't that, you know, necessarily, you know, you would see that this one king was directly managing, you know, everything in every part of the world. There were, you know, subordinate kings. Of course, sometimes he would want to check if they were doing their duties properly. So, you know, just like Yudhisthira, you know, sent out his, you know, brothers, or sometimes they would send out what they call a challenge horse or something like that, you know, to all the subordinate kings just to see if they were still willing to pay their taxes and recognize their subordination to the chief king, you know, the emperor, the Chakravarti, you know, who was ruling from Hastinapur. As for evidence, I mean, there's a basic point of Vedic epistemology: what we accept as evidence. Yeah, evidence means pramanas. So basically, according to the Vedic epistemology, there are three pramanas. There's pratyaksha pramana, the evidence that we get from our senses. Then there's anumana, you know, the evidence that we get by logical inference. And then there's the shabda pramana, or evidence that comes from a perfect source. You know, the evidence that comes to us through our senses is imperfect because the senses are all limited and imperfect. You know, we can't hear every sound. We can't see every electromagnetic vibration. You know, I mean, it's just very well understood that there's ultraviolet light, infrared light that our eyes can't see. There's ultrasound that our ears can't hear. You know, said that even dogs, you know, they can hear sounds that we can't hear. So all of our senses are limited and imperfect. And the mind that we use to evaluate, you know, the evidence that comes from the senses, and we try to hypothesize it may be like this, it may be like that, using logic. That's also imperfect because the mind makes mistakes. The mind can become illusion. The mind can cheat or become the victim of cheating. So although there's some knowledge to be gotten by those methods, it's not very perfect. So therefore, as devotees, we accept as the real evidence shabda pramana, because that's coming from a perfect source. And actually, what we do is we don't judge the statements of Shastra by these lower pramanas. That would mean that material evidence and material logic are superior to Shabda, to Shastra. Rather, we use Shastra to evaluate material evidence and logic. If you use your logic that comes to a conclusion that's harmonious with the conclusion of Shastra, then that's good logic. If by the exercise of your logic you come to some conclusion that contradicts the conclusion of Shastra, then that's bad logic. So, or if you find evidence that, find, you know, material evidence that goes along with the conclusions of Shastra, well, that could be good evidence. If you find material evidence that contradicts Shastra, well, something's got to be wrong with that evidence. So that's how we look at things. So the primary evidence, if you want to talk about evidence, the best evidence is the statements of Shastra, and they say these things. But we can also see that even in historical times, you know, Vedic culture was spread very widely around the world. For example, there's Indochina. They call it Indochina because Vedic culture was there. There's Angkor Wat, big Vedic temple in Cambodia. You go into Indonesia, you know, there are Vedic temples. Even today, Bali, you know, this island in Indonesia, is considered part of Vedic culture. Lord Buddha is a part of Vedic culture. He was a Vedic Kshatriya king, and then he became enlightened in a certain way. Actually, we understand it was by the arrangement of Krishna, you know, that this incarnation appeared to teach a certain kind of nonviolence. And his teachings are spread all over Asia and even into the Middle East, you know, in historic times. So even in historic times, we can see that Vedic culture was very widely spread all over the world. Rome and India were trading. You know, you can find lots of Roman coins in India. You can find Indian objects all over Europe during Roman times. So there was evidence that, you know, the Vedic culture was spread very widely all over the world, even just in terms of ordinary history. Then there are some more controversial topics that maybe aren't so widely accepted, but if you look at, you know, the great civilizations of the Americas, the Incas and the Aztecs, you know, they had these temple structures that are very much like Vedic temple structures in their art and other things. They have tortillas just like chapatis, right? It's all the same. The Vedic culture was spread very widely. So there is, you know, empiric evidence for this. Now, Srila Prabhupada did also say that in some of these outlying areas, you know, the Vedic culture was not so pure and as developed as in the central homeland of it. So on the periphery, we might expect to find things a bit mixed. You know, things might not appear so clearly Vedic, although you can still detect signs of Vedic culture all over the world. Somebody else said yes, Danya.
Since we're being presented in the Vedas with such a clear shot back at history, all the way back, which until recently has been under Vedic rule, so we know that Vedic civilization has been existing and flourishing, does that mean that, like, the modern idea of a prehistoric, so-called, dramatically different Earth, like, say, an ice age, would that be, like, a misnomer?
Not necessarily, because even according to the Vedic system, there's cyclical time. And during the different time cycles, there are different conditions on Earth. For example, during the Satya Yuga, things are much different than they are during the Kali Yuga. So during the different yugas and the different Manvantara periods, it's possible there can be, you know, different kinds of conditions on Earth. And we also see that there are different kinds of weapons that people would have. There was in the battle with Lord Shiva, there's the Shiva Dwar and the, what's the other Dwar? The Narayan Dwar. And one of them produces intense cold all over the earth, and the other produces intense heat. Yeah, so there can be, you know, according to the Vedic cosmology, different climatic conditions, different conditions for living things in different periods of time. And there can also be vast devastations Yeah, as well. Yeah, after every Manvantara period, there's a devastation at the end of Kali Yuga. Lord Kalki comes and does some things, and then things transform. So the idea that there could have been radically different conditions on Earth in the past is not contrary to the Vedic conception of things. Okay, one more. Bhrigupati.
Assuming that a devotee could demonstrate mystic powers publicly, what sort of impact do you think that would have on the scientific community?
Well, probably more important is the impact it would have on the devotee. I would think they would get distracted. So, but it might just cause them to just start worshiping that devotee or something, or and the devotee might become distracted by all the fame and there must be some reason why Krishna doesn't want it done now. I would say there's some reason why Krishna isn't in the Kali Yuga really allowing those things so much. Although sometimes you do see some minor kinds of mystic manifestations. Prabhupada would often talk about different yogis that he was personally acquainted with that were manifesting mystic powers to some degree. And sometimes he would say, yeah, but they're rascals or whatever. So these things are there. And to some extent, that could possibly be helpful. Calling the attention of scientists to these things, if it's possible. It could possibly be helpful in convincing them there's something more than matter. But it appears that Prabhupada and ultimately Krishna want us to do it more by giving arguments. Like Srila Prabhupada would go on his morning walks with his disciples, and on many of them, a good many of them, he'd be saying, the scientists say this, what do you say? What do you say? So it seems like in this day and age, the preferred method for devotees trying to change the ideas of scientists is writing, speaking, and doing work like that. Using logic and reason and evidence to do it. It would seem, as I said, I often thought of that. Well, why doesn't Krishna give me the mystic power to go and float 5 feet off the ground at a scientific conference? But apparently Krishna doesn't think that would be a good idea either for me or the scientists. Okay. We are over time, so we're going to end here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Let's say you were to get $1 million.